You're listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriters. My name is Mark Lintzenmeyer. My guest for episode 209 is the legendary Bruce Hornsby. You're right now hearing his best-known song, The Way It Is, originally recorded in 1986. This is not that version, as we'll talk about. We will mainly discuss Sidelines, a song from his 2022 album, Afflicted, My Resolve, from his 2020 album, Non-Secure Connection, and A Shadow Hand. Again, not the original version from his 1998 album Shadow Trail, but a newly recorded live version released for the 25th anniversary edition of that album in 2023. We'll conclude by listening to Cast Off from his 2019 album Absolute Zero. For more information, please see brucehornsby.com. For more about this podcast, please see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. And if you want to support the effort, go to patreon.com/nakedlyexaminedmusic, which will get you ad-free versions of my episodes, my episode notes that include song structures and lyrics, and you will know that your vital support is what will allow this podcast to continue to exist. So I will play a little bit of some of the live version 2019 of The Way It Is, just to orient folks, to remind them of who you are. However, you were very insistent. Don't use the original version. You got to use a recent thing. I mean, is this a record company issue, or is this just sort of your general attitude towards wanting to stress the new things as opposed to the old?
Well, I consider myself a slow learner, and I'm not a big fan of those early records. I'm mostly not a fan of this guy, the vocalist. So that's it in a nutshell. I prefer a version of The Way It Is, say, or so many things, a live version. So that's why. Very simple.
Were they chorusing the bejesus out of your voice at that age? Because I do feel like those first couple albums and then everything after that, in fact, I read one review, it like doesn't sound like the same guy. And I'm not sure that I would.
There's no chorusing. There's no trickery on it. It's okay. Very plain. It's very, very plain. It's just, again, slow learner. I can't really explain it any better than that. The singer on those records is not the singer that followed. It has nothing to do with vocal treatment. In the last 20 years, I've been more interested in vocal treatment, and that's fun, but nothing radical. I'm not auto-tuning, you know, I'm not flanging my voice or that sort of thing, but maybe a bit of slap here and there, but that's inside baseball. No one cares about that.
Well, that is what this podcast is actually about. It's the inside baseball stuff.
Well, fine. Then, yeah, but it's so funny that you thought it was what you thought it was, chorused or something? Or
something to make it, you know, I noticed the same thing like with Duran Duran, like his voice on those popular singles versus his voice in the rest of his career, like it's thinned out or something.
Often examples like Simon Le Bon's voice on the early Duran Duran records, that can often be attributed to a new band and a veteran producer who has his thumb on the scene. In my case, that's really not true. I can't blame anybody in that scenario. That's the blame game. Oh, well, we were fledglings, and here's the big-time ogre with all the clout, and the big-time resume. Look, my guy, the guy who co-produced the first record, Elliot Shiner, he had that too. He was a big resume guy, most known for the great Steely Dan records. You know, if you're a fan of that music, then you're lionized those records. And he was a big part of them. But in the end, he ran out of time. He had to go do another record. And so we finished it ourselves. So it was the rookies in the room finishing the record, and we did the best we could. And look, obviously it was a great success. The songs hold up well, but not the records. Weren't we going to talk about the Cologne version? We just talked about why I wanted that as opposed to the original record.
Oh, sure.
So Spike Lee came to me. I've worked for Spike Lee since 1992, when he directed a video for my song Talk of the Town for my Harbor Lights record. And so we went from there, kept on working. Every few years, he'd call me for an end title song for Clockers, a song that Chaka Khan and I wrote for him for that. That was the first movie song I performed for him. And then my song Shadowlands, I wrote for Bamboozled record in 2001. Here and there until about 2008, when he asked me to start scoring films for him. So for the next 12 years or so, I did a whole lot of work for him, mostly in his sort of indie, odd, sort of artsy films that no one sees. Films like The Sweet Blood of Jesus and Red Hook Summer, and a score for the NBA 2K16 video game. Two seasons more on the mainstream radar screen. Two seasons of a Netflix series based on his first movie, She's Gotta Have It. I scored both of those seasons. So we worked together for years. Then he called me. The latest thing he called me for was in 2020-21. He was making an HBO documentary called NYC Epicenters. You may have seen it, 2001 to 2021. It dealt with New York City in 9/11 and all the way up through different situations, sort of culminating, oddly enough, with footage of January 6th in D.C. And so he asked me, he wanted to use a version of The Way It Is to be used under that footage. So he called me and asked me to do that. So I sent him a couple of versions, solo piano versions. And so he came back. I sent him two or three different things. He said, I'd like this version from Cologne, solo piano. So I got my great recent partner in musical crime, Rob Moose of Y Music. We just made a record that's coming out in March. He did a string arrangement. And so that's what Spike used. So that's the version from Spike Lee's HBO doc, NYC Epicenters.
Jumping to the present. Sidelines, the opening track from Flicted 2022, featuring Blake Mills, who I assume is the producer guitarist on this.
Yeah, and songwriter, more important.
Okay, so you guys co-wrote this, and then Ezra Koenig from Vampire Weekend, so he's singing the second verse and doing those crazy high backing things.
He's all over it. He kind of becomes a star once he comes in, because I like the way he sounded so much that I featured him in the choruses. I featured him everywhere he sang. I featured him in the third verse where we sing together. Well, he comes into the second verse and sort of does not stop. And that's beautiful because I love what he did.
Can you say a few words about where you were at with this album and this song before we put the song in full?
The Flicted record was written and recorded during the COVID shutdown era. I started early. I wasn't planning on it. But when the world shut down, I was okay in my world because I'm in my studio now. I could just come out to my studio and work. And I could work remotely with my engineer who lives in Richmond. He's figured it out so we could do this and not be in the same room, we're 60 miles away from each other. So I wrote this song basically about the COVID situation. I was ruminating about it and thought about the hysteria surrounding this situation. And it reminded me of the Salem witch trials. And so hence the first verse. I'm traveling now to Salem. I'm a judge in a jury trial. You know, so that's how that comes about. And then it goes from there.
Salem Barristers Waterloo. Oh. hysteria, fear at a fever pitch. Fever streets, walk, don't walk. Cry, sky, ventilators, antennas out. Under the moving sky, moving sky. Open up, hysteria. Fear at a fever pitch. Fever streets, walk, don't walk. Cry, sky, ventilators, antennas out. Under the moving sky, moving sky. As we sit on the sidelines.
So yes, that first verse where you're singing on the offbeats and it has these weird got to get there by, you know, it's like
angular melodic.
Yes, trying to make it sound a little mechanical, a little off. Yeah, any thought about, is that just about the dysfunction of the thing you're writing about? Why you would choose those jumps and that rhythm?
As I grow and evolve, I get more interested in angular melodicism. And so I had this little track that Blake had played for me a couple of years before when he was playing guitar on something else, a song called Meds from our Absolute Zero record, came out in 2019. So I had this very sort of intoxicating part that he played just off the cuff.
So that electric and then the acoustic, you know, those were both together in that part that he showed you, or?
No, he just played this. I'm traveling. That's so I decided to just listen to this and just press record and sing a wordless melody. So since I'm sort of semi well versed in angular melodicism, that's where I went. And went from there. So that's where that comes from. It has nothing to do with the words. The words came, I had some words, but I wanted to just get my feet wet in the beginning, the infant stages of writing the song. And so I just decided to do that. That's the first melody I sang over Blake's guitar. And I liked it a lot. I thought, well, okay, way to go. That was a good first go and never changed.
Yeah, the way that you're singing that, I mean, it sounds like you could have written it on saxophone or something, you know, with those jumps in there. Has the influence of jazz been sort of a constant background? How much of that jazz inflects what you do?
I got my degree in jazz music. I'm well-versed in the Bud Powell, Bill Evans, McCoy Tyner, Wynton Kelly, Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, Keith Jarrett. On, you know, I did my time in that world, and it influenced me. But in this case, no, this is not influenced by jazz because it's very diatonic. It's very scalar. Jazz uses altered notes in chords, you know, and it's more about chromaticism. Sidelines is very, again, diatonic, very much in the key of C. All the white. Sidelines is all about the white notes.
What about that backward piano? I mean, I guess since this song started with that guitar line, if you had written it initially on piano, then to have a producer say, or you decide, let's make it backward, that sort of undoes the composition in a way. Yeah, where did that come in?
I'm lucky enough to be longtime great friends with the great producer Tony Berg. He's most well known recently for producing with Ethan Gruska, the great Phoebe Bridgers records that have just blown up in the world. And so Tony added the backwards piano. And so I liked it so much. He added it just toward the end. I liked it so much that I created a new intro to the intro where the backwards piano starts the song. And then Blake comes in.
Open up hysteria. Fear that I had a fever pitch. Fever streets won't go walk.
You want it to open up and you've got some extra atmospheric, some shimmering, some sort of, is it harpsichord in the right side? Some sort of other keyboard sound to really fill out the stereo space.
It's a dulcimer. It's a stringed instrument. It's an Appalachian dulcimer. I play it all the time. I write a lot of songs on it. That's what you're hearing that really lifts the chorus. Big stringy sound.
Like the fear at a moving, at a fever pit, you know, those sort of rhythmic things. Any thoughts on your construction of this vocal rhythm for this part? Quite different from the previous.
It's very spontaneous. Mm-hmm. I have these lines. I've written the words first. And so I'm going, open up hysteria, fear at a fever pitch. That doesn't work to me. Fear at a fever pitch. It just rolls off the tongue. So I'm just in the moment, spontaneously, just trying to feel what's right, to sing what feels right. So I'm never against adding something like that.
In asking specifically about lyrical lines, we don't have to go down this road, but I'm wondering about the end of the chorus there, the, you know, ventilators all around me or something. But no, it's, we're going to talk about the sky specifically and the moving sky, any thoughts about the choice of that image?
Well, let's see. Crowded sky of ventilators. Yeah, I opened with talking about the sky right before that. Crowded sky of ventilators. It's basically, that's just sort of an attempt at a poetic image of the ventilators everywhere, you know, because that's where we were. I'm just picturing ventilators moving across the sky with the clouds.
You got this sort of fluttering organ something and some, maybe some guitar feedback. How are you constructing this? I want some atmospheric stuff to carry over, you know, and give us a sense of flowing.
Yeah, very specifically, it's the aforementioned Ethan Gruska, Tony's longtime producing partner, who's now producing a ton of things on his own, having great success. We had Ethan come in to play his iPad. He has some sonic trickery that he can deal with on his iPad that makes those sounds.
Yeah.
So it's total software, you know, and Ethan's playing it with his fingers like that. So he just had his way with my whole Afflicted record, starting with that one. And so, yeah, that's exactly what you're hearing. That's making you go, well, what in the world is that? Because people aren't, and that's when I say it's a guy playing his iPad. That's a little confusing, too. And I can't tell you any more than that. I'm sitting right next to him when he's doing it. But he has some sort of way to access interesting sort of cosmic sounds that sound to me very modern. And I'm very interested in all that.
Well, first, I didn't comment on during the second chorus where you have these little fluttery vocal things. Is that your vocal from the first chorus? What is that?
Oh, that's probably just more Ethan.
This fluttering vocal thing. That's so at the part that I just played, we've got more of that, but then we've got all this, instead of a sort of a solo riff or as a solo riff, it's going to be these little parallel octave pluckings, which was a really interesting thing. So is that just guitar? Is that more dulcimer? What is doing that?
Yeah, wow. What is doing that? Okay, I can easily speak to the influence. Those types of sections you would call pointillistic sections, very much related to the music of modern classical composers from the 20th century, Anton Webern, Alban Berg, Elliot Carter, lots of Pierre Boulez, on and on. So many people have dealt in this pointillism in music. And so I love all that, much to the chagrin of some of my old traditional fans who wish I would just do what I did in 1987, you know, but that's okay.
Florid piano runs.
That's just not who I am, but that's the pointillistic section of sidelines. And what's doing it? You know what? Okay. It's a bass playing up high. It's a synth bass playing up high. Yes. Mm-hmm. That's where it is.
Open up hysteria, fear at fever pitch, fever streets walk don't walk, crowded sky, ventilators, antennas out, under the moving sky.
The a cappella harmonized, it sounds like it's something off of Paul Simon's Graceland with the whole African choir, but I assume this is just layered like crazy. Is that?
That's the section where it breaks down to just vocals and then the third chorus comes in. Yes, that's just a lucky score for me. Ezra is great producer and probably one of his best friends, Ariel Rechtscheid, were working on the record for me. And Ezra just came up with this idea and just put it down. And I used every bit of it because I just loved it. So that was a total addition. You'd have to ask Ezra about that specifically because I wasn't there when he did it, but I sure loved it.
Did you even meet him during this process, or is this a...
Oh, no, we're friends. He has a podcast called Time Crisis, and I've been on that several times with him. When I go to LA, every now and then we get together just for a hang.
With the number of featurings, and in fact, the song we're about to talk about in a minute features James Mercer, I didn't know if some of these are just people that you're meeting as you're traveling around, or if this was like, I have gotten the advice, okay, make sure to have, let's get some Vampire Weekend fans involved with this as a record company love match or something. But you're saying, no, these are organic.
You've referenced record companies twice now. I'm totally to blame or credit for all of this. So the record company, I love my record company. They're 30 Tigers, indie label, and they've been great to me. But they don't get involved in this, which is one of the beautiful aspects about being with that label. They're not intrusive. They just stand on the sidelines and applaud and then do their job. But we'll deal with this very specifically. You talked about My Resolve being a duet, but Cast Off is also. And Cast Off was here. And that's where all this started. This quote, Bruce working with young indie rock greats, titans of that world, all started when in about 2015, Justin Vernon of Bon Iver reached out to me and asked me to do a duet with him for an indie rock world Grateful Dead tribute record. He always liked the way I did the great Garcia Hunter song, Black Muddy River. And so he wanted to do a duet with me on that. And I'd been getting all these Google alerts featuring Justin Vernon of Bon Iver shouting me out in the press. So I got interested. I checked out the music and just thought it was fantastic. So then he reached out to me and I went to Eau Claire and we recorded this. It just grew and evolved. Hell, I played Coachella with Bon Iver. I would go and sit in with him on solo concerts when he came near me. We worked on some music for my Absolute Zero record. We co-wrote two songs, one for the Bon Iver record, I, it's called Man Like You or You Man Like. So I say, in a nutshell, when I'm asked to explain this, I put it like this. Justin Vernon opened this door for me, and I went through this door only to find that there were so many more people in that room who felt the same way about me as he did. And so hence Ezra Koenig, who then reached out to me to be on his Time Crisis show and then reached out again to do it again. And then we got together in LA at his house for just a hang. And then I asked him to do Silence. It just kept on growing and evolving with all these people. And James Mercer is yet another one.
All right. So we'll hear Cast Off at the end of this interview. But first, an ad break. Do you know about Songfinch? It is a unique and wonderful service whereby, presumably as a gift to someone special, like for Valentine's Day, this is the perfect time to think about this, you commission a custom written song. You would send them the personal details of your relationship, some things you want them to include, and in 4 to 7 days, you would get back your personalized musical message. In my case, to test the service, I asked them to, in the style of Weezer, come up with a commercial for Songfinch so I did not have to read all their ad points. And here, I'm going to play you the beginning of what they sent me.
Now that you're tuned in to Nakedly Examine Music, maybe you're a bit confused by this voice that's singing. I'm used to a Songfinch artist, ordered by Mark because he mentioned he likes Weezer and I do too. I shredded to the Blue Album in high school, and Songfinch knew, so they picked me to make something comical and upbeat. So I've got the fuzz guitars, I've got the jokes, I've got Mark's stories from this show. Oh, with Songfinch you can give original songs to your partner, friend, enemy, anyone, for any occasion or just because. Filled with inside jokes, filled with love. So check out songfinch.com and order your very own original song.
So that was by a fellow named Yusu Kim, one of many, many artists that they have on their roster. Songfinch has created over 300,000 of these songs. And if you hear what they send you, you have issues with it, you want something tweaked, they'll do that. For a limited time, Songfinch is letting our listeners upload their song on Spotify for free, so you can listen to your new favorite song anywhere you go. Go to songfinch.com/NEM and start your song. After your purchase, you'll be prompted to add Spotify streaming to your original song for free. That's a $50 value. The offer is only available for my listeners at my special URL, songfinch.com/NEM. That's songfinch.com/NEM. Don't wait. Get started now. Let's talk about this James Mercer collaboration.
So we're going to listen to my song, My Resolve, and it features the great James Mercer from The Shins, someone whom I've been a huge fan for years.
Survival line.
So another social commentary song. You're talking about a blasted land. It sounded like this was some sort of
environmental scream.
Environmental song, not necessarily the chorus, but the, okay, so it's not.
No, it's not. It's a song about the Sisyphean task that you're involved with if you're a creative person trying to do something special, do something original, unique, and moving, and how you push that boulder off the rock and you think you're getting it creatively, and then all of a sudden, nope, goes right back down, and you realize, yeah, no, this wasn't it. Try again. Let's write something else. And so this is a song about the Sisyphean task involved in creativity.
So my day job as a podcaster is on a philosophy podcast. So one of the first things we talked about was Camus' The Myth of Sisyphus, and sort of finding joy, finding meaning in even this repetitive task.
Yeah, that's very similar, because obviously in, well, not always obviously, because sometimes you never get there, but hopefully in my world or in my self-appointed job, I do get to the mountaintop where I'm able to give myself chills with the music I'm making. And so it's not always this unrewarding, never-ending toil with no reward. Absolutely. That's what it is. Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting. So talking about my ineptitude stares me down, expressing some sort of, at this point, having produced so much great music, being so, I don't want to say universally revered, but definitely widely revered, given all these young people that you're talking about, that you're still feeling like, insofar as, you know, momentary, songs don't have to express how you feel long term, but they at least have to capture something from a moment of doubt or a moment of something. Yeah, so that's interesting that these ego things.
It's not about recognition, love from peers, or a certain amount of fans. It's very simple. It's about, okay, I'm going to try to write a song. I think I have this idea, and let me start. I thought this was better than this. Let me try something. And there's the start of the self. I often say that my job is keeping the self-loathing at bay. And so this is tangentially related to that idea, because it's not about any accolades or awards that you've won. It's all about, I want to move myself, and that's not easy to do. And so that's a semi-Sisyphean task.
Well, and in terms of just being able to continue creating over time, my issue is that I'm a rather lazy songwriter, and I like to just wait until my unconscious forces me to put something out, which means my input is not that vast at this point, unlike when I was 19.
You're not prolific.
Yeah, yeah. At this point, it's slowed down quite a bit, and many of the songs end up, wow, that's a little too similar to something I've done in the past. So that's my own, but you seem to have be the opposite of that in terms of being completely open to, I'm going to, you know, do whatever it takes to explore these new areas and orchestrating, and I guess literarily as well, you know, being open to, I'm going to base this on books. I mean, does this just make the well endless? And if so, I'm having a little trouble understanding what about it feels like that you're having to push the rock up, as opposed to, here's a new cave I get to explore every single day.
I'm a lifelong student, and I'm always in my older age, in my dotage or senescence, I'm looking to make sounds that I haven't heard before. Hence, say, the combinations in Sidelines of Blake and the piano and the dulcimer. That feels fresh to me. Same with the cast-off sounds. I could keep naming them. So that's what I'm trying to do. But still, you have to write a good song. And I'm using, say, pointillism. You know, that's a modern classical idea in music. So ranging far afield stylistically to find, but basically I'm just following what inspires me. I love modern classical music. Most people hate it, and I understand that, but it's something I've been deeply involved in for about 15, 20 years. I mean, I loved Charles Ives when I was a music student, and Charles Ives, he was the first great true American classical composer who had an original voice, and his stuff even now is very challenging. It's pretty out. So if you listen to the Concord Sonata, everyone loves number 3 because it's very tonal. But 1, 2, and 4, Emerson, Hawthorne, and Thoreau, they are not for the masses. And they're not for people who want to live a white note life and listen to simple music. And so I'm that guy too. And so you've picked more of my simple songs, but on every one of those records, there are a few things that are fairly earbending. I like it all. But I like a simple song too. In the end, all this stuff is fine, but if I don't feel like I'm writing a good song, then none of it matters. I was working on a new song this morning, and just trying to move myself, trying to give myself chills. And I was able to do that this morning. So that makes me feel I'm on the right track when that happens.
Yes, as long as it's still, I mean, this is, so I went through composition school as well. I was fascinated by prog rock. And when you, you know, you have a certain amount of, it seems like, oh, increased complexity, increased, you know, early Beatles to late Beatles, what a revolution. But after a certain point, you hit some, you know, maybe with Henry Cow / Art Bears, like 1979 or so, where it becomes either unlistenable or, as, you know, actually happened historically, is that phase just passes and it's sort of all those bands become more poppy and, you know, they have to deal with the '80s and all that.
That's the trick of it, because I'm not trying to be completely obscure and obtuse and off-putting. I'm trying to find a place in the popular song context for adventurous ideas. And so I'm not trying to be, oh, I don't know, Pierre Boulez, for instance, okay? Although I'm influenced by Boulez, I'm trying to walk that line. I think it's really easy to write real simple music, obviously, and it's really easy to write very obtuse, obscure, completely atonal, completely out music. Like, you know, in free jazz, of course, I'll get suffer the slings and arrows of people who kind of rip me for that. Because there's lots of free jazz that I love. So Ornette Coleman is one of my favorites. I worked with him. So anyway, I think the hardest part and the most challenging and the most rewarding for me is to try to find a middle ground where you are pushing it, but you're still, you're not losing the average pop listener. And I'm sure I've gone too far for that person. If I err, I usually err on that side, and that's okay. But I'm trying to find the middle ground, and always have been.
I sort of found it difficult when I was trying to do this stuff in college and composition. I found that I was still just using traditional theatrical dynamics. Like, you could use really weird chords as long as you still make it understandable that you have big swooping thing, you know. So it just sort of made it like traditional. I've heard it described, not my music, but just sort of the post, you know, when you get into the 1910s, 1920s, whatever, like Stravinsky with wrong notes. In other words, or maybe Stravinsky is Beethoven with wrong notes. I can't remember exactly the image, but the idea that you're still using traditional song structures and things. I mean, I guess the equivalent now is, let's find a new synth sound. Let's have somebody, you know, let's do a fluttering that comes out of an iPad as opposed to a particular weird chord.
Well, the facile way to do it to me is, if you want to take it out, just put a great funky hip hop groove to it. And so there you are. You're kind of in the door right there. And so then maybe over that very basic but great feeling soul groove, you bend the ear a little bit. I haven't done that yet, but I may.
Well, let's get a few more details from My Resolve out. So just that, the drum part, that's very syncopated. It's sort of the whole song sort of has a Sting sort of feel to me, in terms of that he would have Manu Katché or somebody do those. Any thoughts about, was that drum part first?
No, I just wrote that song. A lot of my songs, for instance, the song Cast Off coming up, that was a film cue for Spike. My Resolve, Sidelines, what came from the Blake start, the Blake guitars thing. That was the origins of that song. My Resolve, it comes from this, because this inspiration can come from anything. My older brother, Bobby Hornsby, I used to play in his Grateful Dead cover bands, Bobby Hightest and the Octane Kids. We played grand alcohol parties and frat parties at University of Virginia when I was a freshman in college. So it was little Brucey Hornsby on his Fender Rhodes singing lead on Jack Straw and whatever else, Sugar Bay, whatever. Great Dead songs. And so he has encyclopedic knowledge of old music, 60s, 70s. He's also interested in the modern, too, to his credit. Maybe the only one of his friends that's into that. But we were talking, oh, this is obviously 2 or 3 years ago. Now we're just sitting around talking about music. And we got to talking about the great Stephen Stills and Manassas group and how much we loved that first double record they made with Sing to the Fallen Eagle, Help is on the Way, and all that. Johnny's Garden. The song we loved from that record was a song called The Treasure. And we both saw, I get chills just thinking about The Treasure. I just always loved it. It just moved me. And so we listened to it. I came home and put on The Treasure, found it on YouTube. And I just said to myself, I want to write a song. I want to write my own song that gives me the feeling of this. Hence, you could actually, so you could call the chorus of My Resolve, not unlike a Crosby, Stills, and Nash. It's a three-part harmony thing. So that's where it came from. That was the inspiration. Not that My Resolve sounds of anything like The Treasure.
So this was chorus first, this song, you're saying? Or
I don't remember, to be honest. Lots of times I don't remember, because it's sort of a reverie I get into when I feel like I got a tiger by the tail. I just go down the road and I'm not sure. Sometimes I can tell, like, for instance, Sidelines lyrics came first on that. But with my resolve, I don't remember. Yeah, I think I had the ash plumes rise in electrified skies. I think I had that first and went from there.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like it maybe, I know I thought maybe the drums could have come first, but that three chord sequence seems a more obvious thing to start this out.
It was just me at a piano going, dum, 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 dum.
Any thought about this single note, the synth or violin, this thing that comes in several
times?
It's
not ba-da-da, it's just
right, I'm just counting the eighth notes, yeah.
Well, again, you've already heard it, angular melodicism. If I'm doing a song that's fairly straight chordally, I want to, again, I want to have something in there that bends it a little bit, bends the ear. So I call that diatonic angularity. And that's what it exactly, diatonic meaning it's all scalar. I'm not going chromatic on them. I'm not putting, you know, what would be called a weird note in there. It's all very tonal, but it's, so that's what I like. That's what gets me going. And so, right, another version. This is probably a more intense and more prominent version of melodic angularity than the Sidelines bits.
We haven't talked about your philosophy of bass, that I noticed you kind of kept the bass out of the intro, and then it comes in with the first verse and sort of warms things up, that you let the notes last a little longer. You know, it does some propulsive kind of stuff in the chorus and kind of carries you out of it. Is that all just sort of get the bass player in it and let them do what they want?
That's just me playing synth bass, and just, I probably did it twice, and just, it's just me doing it spontaneously. Obviously, I know the chords, so I'm just going to go. I'm just going to play it. But there's a lot of melodicism in that bass part because it's me playing it on a mini Moog.
Mm-hmm.
All the ring, ding, ding, dong. That's what I like.
So maybe get, you know, a bass player that you would get in to play on it might not even want to be that intrusive or that composition-y, you know, that they'll just want to accompany.
A lot of bass players don't know the instrument well enough to be able to play that melodic. They don't know, a lot of music, bass players don't know the upper end in that way to, you know, you're just not going to hear in the jazz world, you'll hear that, but not that much in the rock and pop world. I did that on a MIDI instrument and I sent the sheet music from the MIDI to my bass player, JB Collier, and he just read it. He's a great reader. So there's synth bass and real bass on that. My man JV played that, but he just basically read my part, played my part.
And then we have that little delay-filled guitar thing that comes in every once in a while and makes it a very sort of 80s Police, again, made me sort of think about that. Any thought about the use of that coming in and out?
That's just my guy, Gib Troll, yep, doing what he wanted to do, and I loved it. That's his contribution, yeah.
I'd been wondering about just how overall heavy a hand you take in the arrangements. It seems like you're very much get good people, let them do cool things, and then work it out in the mix, sort of.
I start the song, obviously, and write it and take the production pretty far along. There's not a whole lot of room once I give the songs to them, but there's enough that they are able to express themselves enough, I guess.
So like with the drum part on this song, did you pretty much dictate exactly what that was going to be?
Very collaborative. My great drummer, Chad Wright, played on it. And I think he just sent it to us. So, and then I might have had a couple of notes about it, a couple of comments. Hey, can you do this here? Can you try this there? And that's it.
Hey, it's another ad break. I need to tell you about Green Chef, a CCOF certified meal kit company. Green Chef makes eating well easy with plans to fit every lifestyle: keto, paleo, vegan, vegetarian, gluten-free. Or even if you're just looking to eat more balanced meals, Green Chef offers a range of recipes to suit your preferences. If you are like me, your body no longer appreciates when you shove a bunch of crap into it. Green Chef would like to elevate your everyday wellness and is committed to providing a holistic approach to nutrition by offering meals that contribute to the overall well-being of your entire body. Each week, they now feature new gut-friendly recipes crafted to actively support the well-being of your gut and enhance cognitive health. So enjoy nutrient-dense, science-backed gut and brain health recipes developed in partnership with registered dietitians to improve digestion, reduce bloat, and boost energy and immunity. Green Chef's a great way to build healthy habits. They take the work out of eating clean. You're going to get certified organic fruits and vegetables, organic cage-free eggs, sustainably sourced seafood. Green Chef's diverse menu includes over 80 flavor-packed options each week. Savor Green Chef's seasonally inspired recipes, where they celebrate the peak ingredients, flavors, and freshness of every season. I have really enjoyed Green Chef. I have been a customer now and again out of my own pocket. Their meals are delicious, much fancier than I would come up with on my own. Coming up with recipes, going to the grocery store specifically to get things for those recipes, too much work. Green Chef has been a welcome relief from that process. So go to greenchef.com/60nakedly and use the code 60nakedly to get 60% off plus 20% off your next 2 months. That's greenchef.com/60nakedly, code 60nakedly. You get 60% off your first order plus 20% off your next 2 months. Green Chef, the number one meal kit for eating well. I think this transitions us well to the third song. So was this just complete and then you had him come in and do some extra singing, or was this a more collaborative experience with him?
I just sent it to him. I've never met him in person, but we've talked a lot. We ended up doing a podcast together, just having a conversation, James and Bruce, for an hour on somebody's podcast. He's a beautiful guy. I just love the Shins. I'm really more of a mid-career Shins fan than the original stuff. I like that. But they made a record called Wind Sing the Night Away in about maybe 2008, 2009. Had these incredible songs on there. It's a song called Spilt Needles that I think is just so strong. And he's such a melodicist as a writer. I love so many of his songs. Caring is Creepy, on and on. So I just got in touch with him and reached out to him. And he said, well, okay, send me the song. I said it to him. And he got back, said, yeah, I'm in. Let's go. And so this record, having come out in June or so of 2020, right in the beginning of the COVID shutdown, it led us into making these remote videos together for different shows. We did it for Stephen Colbert. We did it for the virtual Bonnaroo Festival. I recorded the piano, which is piano and two guys singing. I recorded my part and he sent it to him and he did that. So that was great.
Yes, I will share the link. I was just watching that before we got on. So I will share the link of that performance in the show notes here.
Those are really fun. I love the guy and I'm so proud to have worked with him.
Was there, I mean, because of course I was reading in like that, the sound that's used for that, that could be on a Shins album from that era. I mean, was it?
Yeah, that seems absolutely true.
Okay. So was it the fact that you were already doing that kind of stuff made you think this sounds like the one to invite him on? Like what would make you invite him on this song as opposed to a different one?
Maybe subconsciously on a sonic level, I was thinking of the sound of the Shins. Would I use the synth sound for the angular melody?
Well, let's transition to the third song. So you are currently marketing the 25th anniversary of the 1998 album, Spirit Trail. The song Shadow Hand you picked. However, it was, no, not the original version, which has a very Pete Townsend who like, you know, it's got the, it's got the running synth. It's got the My Love Opens the Door sort of progression. These live trail versions, are they from that time, from the 1998 tour, or are they just these songs done in some subsequent?
The live trail record is showcasing my band in the past year.
Okay.
Yeah, that's not a synth on the original Spirit Trail Shadow Hand. That's a Casio. I wrote the song on a Casio keyboard on my bus on the road. That's an old time Casio. If I was in the studio, I could show the studio. It's just a funky old relic. And right then I went, I'm shaking my shadow head. That's just so Pete Townsend. Homage is all. Steal from the best.
Well, let's listen to the brand new live trail version.
Learned so far, don't believe I'm so strange. In spite of all this time I spend calling the air by name, when the first light goes over the trees, you'll be singing with me. If I feel like singing alone, he always leaves me be. I'm shaking my shadow head as the sun moves round the bend. with an imaginary man, and we'll make believe round and around again. I'm shaking my shadow head. It's my shadow head. There's a man out walking around in the night, lantern in his hand, looking all around, searching it in vain for an honest man. In my little world of make-believe, I talk to myself about friends. In some real life becomes a tempting hit me. I'm going back in my room again. I'm shaking my shadow hand as the sun moves around the bend, with an imaginary man, and then the make-believe around and around again. And I'm shaking my shadow head. To pretend to think I'd do it again, though cards are set, no torn heart to bend. Little imagination and then a world of fantasy with my friend. I'm shaking my shadow head as the sun moves around the bend, with an imaginary man, and we'll make believe lean around and around again.
So for this live version, we get a very different interpretation. Bluegrass, is he playing spoons? Is that what the percussion is?
Playing a washboard. Yeah, it's a part of our concert for many years now. I started playing dulcimer. Actually, the first song I ever used dulcimer on was Shadowhand on Spirit Trail back in 98. I just bought dulcimer and I use it on that. It's very prominent. Ding, 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 ding. So look, Shadowhand is a song that's been dear to me. It's a song about my sons who had imaginary friends when they were 4 or 5 years old and would come to the dinner table and tell us about what they did. And I thought this was a little odd. And so I started thinking about my time in music school, living alone. And I kind of remember maybe talking to the wall myself. And so maybe I had an imaginary friend too. So Shadowhand is, to me, one of my top 15, 20 songs that I've written. And it's very simple. I wouldn't call it bluegrass at all, but it's a very folky thing. And obviously folk is related to bluegrass in some ways. And so we have a section in our concerts every night where we call it our back porch moment. And my drummer, the aforementioned Chad, plays washboard with the spoons. And I play the dulcimer, and our fiddle mandolin guy, John Malander, so great. He plays both. And there we go. And there we're off. And so that's what Shadowhand. That's that version of Shadowhand. And I love that version. I'm really fond of it. I like everything about it. And so it had to be included on the live trail part.
We haven't really talked about some of your vocal choices. So this has a lot of ostinato on some of the imaginary, you know, these kind of let's extend out words in creative ways. And I know these are a little different than the 1998 version. In fact, some of the words are even a little tweaked from, is this just, you're playing it live a lot and you're going to try different stuff. Is there anything more to it than that?
I'm just better at all this than I was then. And that's 25 years ago. And so I'm really influenced by Irish music. I love Paul Brady is one of my icons and monument to me. So much. Shane McGowan, all of that. So that's so Irish to me. That's where I get it. That's what you're talking about on Shadowhand. Shadowhand's a perfect song to mine the Irish vocal phrasing book.
You can hear yourself on this recording talking to the musicians as if, like, are you actually saying, hey, mandolin player, you should actually take the next solo. You know, I know the electric guitarist just did that riff, but I want you to do it this, or is that all pretty much the sequence is already worked out?
No, nothing's worked out. That's why you hear me saying, okay, why don't you do this? Let's break it down. It's you and me play this. Or I'll point to a musician and I'll point to me and say, okay, it's going to be the two of us. It happens all night. If you come to our concerts, you'll see it all night long. I'm just sort of the ringleader trying to entertain my band and keep fresh for myself and them and hopefully the audience. But if you're there for a night of replication, a stroll down memory lane, nostalgic night out where you hear the songs played again, replicating the original. That's not what we do at all.
With having this increased freedom, how much do you miss the vocal harmonies? Like there are no vocal harmonies on this version.
Vocal harmony on Shadowhand is not a prized idea. There probably were some vocal harmonies on the original, but I don't think they were anything special. It's not like My Resolve, where imagine My Resolve without the harmonies of the chorus. No way. So, of course, we're in three-part harmony, just trying to do that as well as we can and make it glorious and beautiful. But Shadowhand, it could be. If I had Emmylou Harris and Bunny Raitt hanging with me, I'd say, hey, let's try a three-part harmony on this.
I mean, it's always interesting sort of what ends up being considered the song. I mean, obviously the words and the melody, but there's some songs that I've had where you know, I really like the bass part I did that I recorded 10 years ago. And new bass player, please learn that exact bass. At least learn that riff. The melody has to be in there somewhere, as opposed to so many other things that, no, they can just fall by the wayside.
That's in the moment. For instance, just take The Way It Is. There are certain touchstone moments, like in the intro, the little bass part there. That's just something that we do every night.
It's not to Bob Dylan lengths, where I know people have seen Bob Dylan live that, like, it's a minute into the song, you're just figuring out what song it is because it has thrown away so many of the original.
And I love him for that. I just saw him about 3 weeks ago in Richmond, and the order of the day is try to figure out what song he's playing. And that's fun. It's beautiful. But that said, when I play The Way It Is, like that Cologne version of The Way It Is, that part is not in there. It's inappropriate in the way I'm playing it. I'm playing it much more slowly, much more ruminative, really hear the words. And so it's not applicable. Every now and then, there are things that we do every night.
All right. Well, to wrap up here, I feel like you've already introduced Cast Off. We already talked about that earlier, but that's what we're going to leave folks with.
It's an interesting story. I was making my record Absolute Zero, and I sent some of it to Justin, and he said, wow, this is really different. Sometimes this sort of adventurous idea doesn't end well. He said it in an email to me, but hey, you should come out here and maybe we'll help you with it. So I went to Eau Claire. We did a gig at a hotel. He's part owner, Oxbow Motel at Eau Claire. And then we had 4 or 5 days in the studio, in their studio, April Bass. And I had brought to the sessions about 20 different cues that I'd written for Spike Lee. So I played them for him. And there was this one called Cast Off. I titled it Cast Off just so I would remember the derivation, where it came from, the inspiration. I was scoring film for Spike, and I thought I needed something sort of grand, sweeping, epic sounding. And so I listened to the score for the Tom Hanks movie, Castaway. Now, what I did sounds nothing like that, but it did lead me to a place that turned into this film cue that Spike never used. So I had it. I played it for Justin. Boom, 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 that melody. And then he said to me, you know, Cast Off seems like a good title. Why don't you work on that? So I thought, okay, let me give that a shot. And so the song ends up being about a guy who has been rejected so much, but he's learned how to love rejection. He embraces it. So it's kind of an odd song in that way. He's not feeling sorry for himself. He's just going, well, this is what's happening, and I'm okay with it, and I'm good with it. I'll embrace it. And so I put down a few words, and he went and sang, and it just gradually grew and evolved into the song Cast Off with Sean Carey, singing backgrounds from Bon Iver. Pretty much a lot of the Bon Iver crowd was in there, and they would just be hanging out in the house, and then someone would call them in, hey, it's your turn. Come in and play on this one. So it was just a fantastic time. Again, we ended up writing a song together that was on the fourth Bon Iver record, I, which came out the next year, called You Man Like. And so that's the story. It just came from that. And that's why some of the keyboard sounds have a bit of a Bon Iver feeling to them, I feel.
Really fascinating spending this much time going through your catalog and all the different places you've explored, and a real pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much for doing this.
My pleasure, Mark. It's always fun to get in the weeds and talk about stuff that I feel like most people probably couldn't give a rat's about. But for your coterie of nerds and geeks like you and me, this might be something they would enjoy.
It's terrible, but it don't feel so bad. I'm a vine, and I may hold the key for being gratefully glad. There's no way down, smile in my face, my man, all the time you want to hit the place. Here's my back for stabbing. Well, you cast me on.
cast off, be a discarded toy. I'll be your cast off, your maybe sometime choice. Your rejection for okay, I'll take what I can get and like it. I'll be your cast off, be your discarded one, discarded toy, discarded chew toy.
Thanks so much to Bruce. I'll be honest, I reached out to Bruce because I'm on some lists from promo people. I saw he had this 25th anniversary edition. Thought, hey, everybody knows the name Bruce Hornsby, at least if you're as old as I am. Why don't I try to get this guy? I had never really heard anything beyond his major label work in the 80s. Did not know that he acquired this different, smokier voice. I knew he had done some work as the keyboardist for the Grateful Dead and interacted with Jerry Garcia, but did not know that he had continued to put out such a wide range of really smart, adventurous, cool music. We've, of course, only gotten into a very small portion of it. He wrote a musical that was performed. He's collaborated with big-name jazz guys, like he has an album with Christian McBride and Jack DeJohnette. He recorded a bluegrass album with Ricky Skaggs. He has very fleshed-out orchestral arrangements on several of his albums. And you've heard him talk about how he's delved into the classical tradition and what that became in the 20th century. So definitely not someone to be dismissed as a one or three hit wonder from the 80s, if you're even thinking of doing that. Ridiculously talented. I am honored to have spoken to him. I consider this one of my best episodes. So check him out. Go to brucehornsby.com. Maybe buy an album. Throw a little money at the guy. I will definitely be looking to see him live whenever I get the opportunity. But the fun does not stop there. I have recorded episodes now with Matt Piucci, who was the guitarist and singer with a band called Rain Parade in the early 80s, but went on to play with Neil Young's Crazy Horse, you know, in the time when Neil Young is not playing with them. So he was sort of the substitute Neil Young, and has recorded for several projects with his own music and collaborations. Over the years, I am just about to record an interview with Louis Michaud from the Lost Bayou Ramblers, which is very new to me. I knew nothing about Cajun music. And if you know about the Pogues, what they did to Irish music, Lost Bayou Ramblers does that to Cajun music. So makes it modern, makes it cool. There's some 21st century production techniques and fuzzed guitars on some of it. It's also still very rooted in the tradition, including having lyrics entirely in French. And I don't want to reveal who I'm set to interview next, but it's another biggie, a guy whose career goes all the way back to 1974 or so. Hopefully that one won't fall through. Hopefully I'll be able to tell you about it next time. Hope you're doing well. Hope your holiday season was great. Enjoying the new year. We're having ridiculous snows here in Madison, Wisconsin. Very low temperatures, but the snow is still very light and fluffy. My dog loves to romp in it. I love watching the birds flitting around our bird feeder, which has a foot of snow on top of it. Hilarious. Until next time, keep on musicking. This is Mark Linsenmeyer signing off.